You're listening to the Monaco Daily, first broadcast on the 7th of May, 2024 on Monaco Radio. Israel closes Rafah's border crossing, ignoring demands to reopen it. Vladimir Putin's inauguration is boycotted by almost every major Western country but France. And when do foot-in-mouth gaffes from politicians actually make sense? I'm Chris Chermak. The Monaco Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monaco Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. My guests, Jenny Mathers and Yossi Meckelberg, will discuss the day's big stories and we'll hear about some of the weirdest museums available for a visit in Croatia. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monaco Daily. This is the Monaco Daily, and I'm Chris Chermak. I'm joined today by Jenny Mathers, a senior lecturer in international politics at Aberystwyth University, with a research focus on Russian politics and security, and by Yossi Meckelberg, associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Jenny, listeners on many shows of Monaco will know you very, very well, but you have to introduce yourself to the daily audience. This is your first time as a panelist on this show.
It is, because mostly I'm sitting in my office in my home talking to you over my internet connection, and so it's a pleasure to be in the studio. So I teach and research at Aberystwyth University in the Department of International Politics, which is the world's first international politics department. Founded in 1919. We always like to say that. And I work mainly on Russia, Russian politics and security, but I also work on women in war and gender in conflict. And I do some research where all of those things intersect.
What is Aberystwyth like? I've never been. What is it like for you over there?
It's a quiet seaside town. It is a very Welsh. It's a very Welsh-speaking area. There's a very strong sense of community. It houses the National Library of Wales, which is a fantastic resource, which is right adjacent to the campus. So it's amazing. There's a lot of Welsh culture that goes around, a lot of Welsh politics discussions that happen, and our students are very, very keen and motivated to learn more about the world.
Yossi, you need absolutely no introduction to listeners of this show, but is there anything where, if Jenny is traveling all the way from Aberystwyth, have you traveled anywhere else recently?
I've been to Barcelona, and I don't know. It's thanks to the war in the Middle East, which no one should think it in any shape or form. There are a lot of meetings taking place in different parts of the world. So we're traveling, and the lack of interest before the war, which was painful because everyone neglected, all of a sudden want us to come with some magic solution that obviously we don't have. But yes, so Barcelona was the last one and Berlin is the next.
So you're getting lots more invites, is that fair to say, for talks, solutions, discussions?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I, of course, here as well, but also from abroad, because there is a sense that this conflict has been neglected for a long time. And when it's all fell apart, now everyone is looking for instant solution, they don't exist. And now we have kind of a very long haul of trying to rebuild the relation between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, on that note, we will start this show in Gaza because Israeli defense forces have now claimed control of the Rafah crossing with Egypt and generally surrounded the southern Gazan city, halting aid and general traffic in and out and prompting further warnings from the United Nations and others that any full attack on Rafah will have a tremendous impact on an already dire humanitarian situation. All of this is happening despite reports last night that Hamas had accepted a ceasefire. Those mediation efforts are said to be ongoing. Yossi, this is not a full assault at the moment, but it almost might as well be. Is that fair to say?
Depends how you see that. Is it part of the brinkmanship, part of actually the war is part of the negotiation? That's the way they communicate with one another. Or it's separate, and to a large extent it has to do with the pressure on Netanyahu domestically. He is the far right, which no one has any sympathy for him for having the far right. He the one legitimized them. He's the one that formed government with them. He needs to live with them. And he did it in only order to stay in power. But right now they're telling him, if you don't enter into Rafah, what's the point of having this government? They think that, you know, Israel needs to complete the war, set the objective of eliminating Hamas, which is, I think we said it in this studio so many times, that it's unachievable objective. So this might be part of it, but also basically controlling the border with Egypt will also can control what enters into Gaza, also from this part of Gaza. And I think whether it's the plan actually for a full-blown attack, they're planning it, and Netanyahu said, even if there is an agreement, even there is ceasefire, even there is exchange of hostages for prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, still will get into Rafah. So that's where we are here. On the other end, the negotiation talk about truce, but also truce that will go from something which is more temporary to something permanent. So there are some parallel talks that some of them are contradicting each other.
Jenny, I mean, when Yossi talks about the domestic pressures there, I mean, is that something that we should have always expected? Was there ever any expectation on your part that Israel and Netanyahu might also listen, say, to the international community?
Well, I think this is what we've discovered, is that the International Court of International Public Opinion is not really doing much work here. And even, you know, whatever pressure the Biden administration is putting on Netanyahu is clearly not being very effective. It's not something that he feels the need to bow to. So, it seems to me that domestic politics in Israel is going to be the place where change comes, if it comes.
Well, and to that point, Yossi, I mean, what is your sense of where Israel stands on this? On the one hand, yes, Netanyahu's base is pushing for more aggressive actions and a full-scale invasion of Rafah. But there are also protests. There are dissenting voices. I mean, is there really full unity in Israel on this course of action?
Well, not at all. The majority of Israelis, wanted a different government. They want election. They want Netanyahu to go. And just on the way to the studio, a new survey that said most Israelis support a deal with Hamas to release the hostages. But Netanyahu needs, for his own sake, the majority of 64 MKs in his coalition, in the Knesset, in order to survive. And again, when we said so many times before that it's almost impossible, untenable for a prime minister that faced corruption trial, also take decision of life and death for his country, the national interest on stake. We didn't even imagine before October 7 how right we were on this issue. And now it's very difficult to tell, is it about his personal survival? Is it about the country? Are there strategic consideration there or not at all? Because the minute that the war is over, one option is actually if they don't go to Rafah, then the far right leaves. Not that they have any other option. Or investigation of the failure of October 7 and the war to follow, probably fresh election, and this might be, or probably would be, the end of Netanyahu's political career. He doesn't want it. Then he faces his corruption trial, without being a prime minister, without the pressure on the judiciary. Furthermore, at his age, also I think about his legacy. He was supposed to be the protector of Israel, the defender of Israel, and this fell apart over the last 7 months.
Jenny, when you're mentioning the International Court of Public Opinion, one other interesting aspect of that when it comes to that international court is that there have been these comparisons, I suppose, drawn between Ukraine, what Russia is doing, and Israel and Hamas and all of that. You have sort of these cries of hypocrisy over, you know, from many over the West's treatment of Ukraine versus its treatment of Israel. Is this, as a Russia expert, is this giving Russia an upper hand, do you think, at this moment, kind of in its own battle for the International Court of Public Opinion?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that Putin is actually very clever at, is picking up those moments when he can take advantage of differences and tensions, either within a domestic public opinion within a country or internationally. And so certainly one of the things that he's been doing, you know, very consistently since, you know, the mass invasion began is arguing that, you know, Russia is exposing the hypocrisy of the West, right? Russia is demonstrating that all of us talk about democracy and human rights and so on is not to be taken seriously because the West only operates in its own interests and wants a hegemony of the West, basically. And so, yes, the sights every day of you know, children and people in Gaza dying and suffering, you know, this, terrible as it is, it also feeds Putin's rhetoric in a very effective way. And it plays very well, especially to countries that are, you know, skeptical, have good reason to be skeptical about the veracity of Western promises.
Yeah, so just a final word maybe on that. I mean, if, as you say, Netanyahu is facing these domestic political pressures that make him determined right now to do what he is doing, we've spoken about this show on this show before about kind of the rebuilding, the aftermath. But also I wonder from you, when we talk about something like the moral high ground, is that something that will matter to Israel once it has completed its mission? If the goal is simply to destroy Hamas at this point, finish the operation in Rafah, what comes after that?
You know, sometimes in my head I'm going on different scenarios, how Israel could have approached the post-October 7 in a way that it could retain the high moral ground. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, without taking away to the terrible atrocity of October 7, that it lost its more high moral ground. Because you can't do what Israel has done in Gaza and still claim morality when you kill so many civilians, let alone the occupation and the blockade on Gaza even before that. It will take many years to rebuild this reputation. This is a country, and again, as someone who served in the Israeli military, that we always talk about the purity of arms, to being the most moral army in the world. What's left of that? Absolutely nothing. And part of the establishment of the State of Israel came out of moral obligation post-1945. So morality and ethics are part and parcel of the State of Israel and the Jewish state. And the way that it's shifted from 67 and definitely in the 16 years that Netanyahu has been in power, it's damaging in the long term, takes very long time to repair.
Some sobering thoughts there, Yossi, but we will move on for now from that, because we will move on to Russia, because today marks the inauguration of Vladimir Putin to a fifth term in office, something that once would have been banned in Russia's constitution. But of course, these days, there are no limits beyond Putin's own desire to lead his country. The inauguration was largely boycotted by the West, but officials from six EU members did attend, most notably France. Jenny, this inauguration was so obviously expected, but what were your thoughts watching today?
Well, it's, you know, you wonder what Putin was thinking, really, because here we are again, you know, for the fifth time. It didn't seem to excite him. You know, he didn't seem enthused. He didn't look like a man who was really pleased to be there and excited to be taking on yet another term of office. So, you know, he seems to be in this paradoxical situation where he feels this sense of obligation, perhaps, or just simply doesn't trust anyone else to take the reins of power from him and do the job that he thinks needs to be done. But on the other hand, he just doesn't look like someone who's enjoying himself. He really looks very uncomfortable and bored most of the time. So I think in some ways he'd quite like to step down, but he's convinced himself that there isn't anybody else that he can hand things over to.
It's interesting. Just to, yeah.
So I something a bit this kind of, let's call it, there is no democracy in Russia anymore. So it's basically back to dictatorship. And I think it's not only in the case of Russia. Dictators can't just leave office. Mm-hmm. Because they tie their survival with office. So even if you say you're tired and say, you know, maybe it's nice to go you know, to one of my duchies somewhere in the Black Sea. I just can't, because I'll end in jail. I'd be killed. So the only way to survive is to guarantee through the Constitution another 12 years.
And keep going.
And keep going. And then you will be 83, and then probably they change the Constitution again.
Well,
is that it, though? You think he just can't, would like to leave but can't? Or is it about a sort of moral mission that he believes he's on? I mean, where does this come from if he's not so enthused anymore?
Well, I think he does seem to be increasingly going down this rabbit hole of his of a moral mission, and it's to, you know, protect the greatness of Russia, is to protect the identity of Russia, is to protect the history of Russia, even because he now presents history as being under threat from the West and from Russia's opponents, and that if they are allowed to belittle the Soviet Union's great victory of the Second World War, for example, this would amount to, you know, the end of Russia as we know it. So it's really out there, exaggerated, you know, claims and expectations, and you do wonder. I think it's a combination of several different factors, but it is worth pointing out that Patriarch Kirill, when he gave the blessing at the inauguration, said that he hoped that Putin would be in power until the end of a century.
So. End of the century. One of my colleagues, Lex Self, is going to a longevity summit, I believe, later in the next couple of weeks. I guess maybe that's what Putin is looking at as well.
76 years.
That would be pretty amazing. I mean, Yossi, what did you make of the international appearances here? That is an interesting aspect of this, I think, this decision, right? Whether to even bring an ambassador, are you recognizing a dictator, frankly? Is that, well, they are still the leader of the country, whether they were fairly elected or not. What do you make of that sort of dilemma, I suppose? France decided to attend, but most others didn't.
Yeah, obviously, we'd expect a proper dictator to win more than 87% of the vote. You know, it, for instance, the Middle East, it used to be 99%. So something...
That's a little too obvious at that point, though.
I know, but it's something went wrong there. But reality, I think this inauguration actually re-emphasized the isolation of Russian. That's, you know, very few actually came. And the one that actually attended the inauguration are the other dictators. So while the Baltic states criticized the inauguration and Putin as a dictator, and so that's from Russian point of view, probably they've been better off without having this big ceremony. But you can't not have a ceremony, so you hold it. But again, and in 2 days, it's Victory Day as well. So you have another set of parades to celebrate. And again, as you say, Jenny, it's kind of the history of the Soviet Union and the victory. And as Putin is carrying the torch of the history and combined between what happened then and now, and taking also the war in Ukraine as part of maintaining and retaining this kind of history, which of course no one else is believing in that, including probably many of the 87% people that voted for him in the election.
Jenny, is there any reason to believe, again, given that this is an inauguration that at this point, I mean, he's just a forever president, as we were talking about before the show as well, but is there any reason to believe Putin will do anything different with his fifth term? Does he have an agenda, as it were, for his fifth term?
Well, when he gave a State of the Nation address not long ago, he did talk in terms of, you know, improving the lives of people in Russia and so on. But it's gone so far in the other direction. I mean, when he first, very, very first, became president, oh, so long ago, he did actually bring greater prosperity to Russia, partly as a fluke because global energy prices rose and Russia is a net exporter of energy, and so it was able to earn lots of hard currency. So there were reasons for that. But nevertheless, he did have that reputation of bringing prosperity and bringing a better way of life to the people after a very difficult decade in the 1990s. But since the war in Ukraine in particular, you know, people's standards of living have not improved, with the exception of those actually families of those who are serving in the armed forces. Because now, in order to persuade people to sign up, The families are now getting more benefits. Soldiers are now getting higher salaries. And if they're killed in action, then the families get additional benefits as well. So there is a bit of a redistribution going on there, but it's for a very grim reason. So, yes, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of optimism in terms of what Putin is genuinely offering to the country, with a war that's seemingly going on to go on forever, will absorb more and more life. There's not a lot of optimism there.
Yasui, just as a final word, because we discussed this on yesterday's show, but what do you make of this when Jenny talks about conscription? Because that's something that obviously Israel also has the same kind of battles. We were talking about Ukraine's battle for conscription yesterday as well. How do you see that about trying to convince, keep morale up in countries? Putin is just using money from the sounds of it, but you need some moral high ground again, I guess, suppose, as well.
Yeah, you need sense of purpose. Why do you do that? And again, as a former conscript, you know, I know what's, you know, at the age of 17, 70, you get this letter that going to do all these tests and exams with the military to see where they are going to send you. And if you don't have the ethos within the society that you do it for the nation, at the end of the day, soldiers, when you're already in the army, you mainly fight for your friends more than for your country, because that's the friends, your comrades, if you put it in Russian, this is the most important. But if people don't believe in the cause to begin, and think this one of the things right now with Israel, if you stop believing in the cause, then all more and more people, or young people, say, we'll find a way not to be part of conscription. In Israel, it's more problematic because you have the ultra-Orthodox that don't serve in conscription, some others that don't get away, so some other find ways also not to serve, so it's a smaller and smaller problem. On the other hand, there are some that are very motivated. Again, in the case of Israel, for instance, you know, the settlers and those from the far, you know, from the right, are more motivated to do that. But this changes also the nature of the army.
The complexion of the army.
So this complex, all new complexion there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to the French-speaking part of Belgium, known as Wallonia, because the region is engaged in an interesting media experiment, one could say. Media in Wallonia have been engaged in a concerted effort to keep far-right politicians off the airwaves as part of what they call a cordon sanitaire, or protective barrier. It's an idea typically reserved for mainstream political parties who do not want to work with the far-right, but it is now being extended to mainstream media. And if polls are anything to go by, then it might be having some effect on the two far-right parties' popularity in the region. Jenny, does this approach make you applaud or cringe?
Well, it's really interesting. It goes to the heart of how do you deal with groups that use disinformation, that tell lies, that say such extreme things and really try and bring the population with them or drive the population further in that direction. And I think we should make a distinction between short-term and long-term, prospects and tactics, because possibly in the short term, something like this might be effective to sort of remove the poison from the airways to some extent. But I think eventually they will find a way of getting around it, as indeed they have in Belgium with social media, for example. I think there's probably no substitute for doing it the long, hard way, which is through education, through democracy, through listening to people's grievances, through dealing with problems, through just doing the hard, basic work that takes a long time to bring people with you and to create a consensus. And it seems to me that that is the only way. But of course, it's not very quick and easy. It's not something that you can sell to a politician and say, do this, and in a month, your problem will disappear. So it's a tough one, I think.
It is a tough one. And Yossi, I mean, there's two aspects to this. One is Jenny is talking about kind of the effectiveness of it. The other is, we've been talking a lot about morality on this show, but for journalists, is it your sense that media are obligated to report and debunk stories from any group they see fit, or do they also have the right to not report at all?
There is a right not to report, and you know, some sort of self-censor. But yeah, we have also in the media some responsibility to the democratic system. Also, democracy has the right to protect itself. And we saw cases in history that anti-democratic forces using the democratic system in order to destroy it. Mm-hmm. But as Jenny said, it's such a difficult decision to make because the lines are blurred. At one point, you're actually making decision, I just don't like their opinion, and then I exclude them from the national discourse, or it's something which democracy defends and protects itself. The law can help with that. For instance, who is allowed to run and who is not? Where is there is hate speech? And when there is something which is legitimate, again, because I'm in the middle of writing a piece about what's happening in campuses in the United States, is because the Americans have the First Amendment, which I think is the most abused, together with the Second Amendment, of course. Amendment of Bill of Rights. Yes, you want people to have the right free of speech and to express themselves. But when it ends in incitement against other communities, then maybe we have this obligation to stop it. And it's at the end of the day, we have to admit, it's a judgment either made by individuals or by society as a whole.
Well, absolutely. And aside from the judgment of whether to cover it at all or not, as this kind of very express step that was taken in Valonia, Jenny, we were also talking before the show about cases of, say, Donald Trump and this question of maybe not covering at all, but just how much oxygen you give an individual and the role that the media in that sense can play by simply covering too much. Is that something that we have to keep more of an eye on? How do we best cover somebody making outrageous statements?
I think this is absolutely true. I mean, I remember visiting the U.S. at various points during Trump's presidency and just being shocked by how much the news of the day was driven by what Trump had tweeted that day, because they would report on what he tweeted, and then they would have a panel discussion about it, and then they would have, you know, more reports about what other people had tweeted, and so on. And so the fascination by the American news media with Trump started during his candidacy, lasted throughout his presidency, and still continues. And I think there is a real question about journalistic responsibility. You know, how far do you go in following really quite sensationalized stories, and how much are they, you know, not consciously but effectively building it up? And certainly I've talked to some American journalists who have expressed a lot of regret that's what happened back in, you know, sort of 2016.
Yossi, just finally on this, also on the politician side, I'm just curious what you think of this idea of a cordon sanitaire, the idea that you do not work with a far-right party. Does that help? Is there a danger there, too, that in the case, whether it's Israel or other places, that eventually the far-right simply gets in as the lead party?
I think in some cases the media, because they like the circus that come with some of them, and by complete coincidence, in my household, we are watching a Belgian TV series called Pandora. I don't know if anyone's watching, but it relates to this. Highly recommended. It's exactly this, because sometimes the media, because they enjoy the extremes of the debate, then they build up them and legitimize. Probably politicians shouldn't be legitimized because it makes better media. And that's where, you know, we need to reflect on it. At that point, we actually shouldn't do that and have this kind of block. But it's problematic in a democracy whether we are becoming in the media censors of what is right and what is wrong. Also, we're using the term far right and far left, but
also confusing. Who
decides what is the far in the right or in the left?
Absolutely. Well, finally, for our panel today, U.S. President Joe Biden has long had a knack for putting his foot in his mouth, ruffling the feathers of foes and allies alike, often by saying things that everyone's thinking but no politician wants to say out loud. His most recent incident has been labeling Japan a xenophobic nation in an offhanded remark, highlighting why some countries struggle with demography and a weak economy. Japan's, Tokyo's chief cabinet secretary responded today that the comment was regrettable and not based on a correct understanding of Japan's policy. About as much fighting words as you'll probably get from the Japanese to this. Jenny, we did want to highlight one other famous clip of Joe Biden saying something everyone's thinking before we continue.
Well, look, he is. I mean, he's a dictator in the sense that he is a guy who runs a country that is a communist country that is based on a form of government totally different than ours.
So this was Joe Biden calling Xi Jinping a dictator in response to a question as well. The one thing we can't show is the reaction of Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, when he said this at the time. What do you make of these kinds of comments, Jenny? Is there anything wrong with kind of telling it like it is?
Well, I suppose it is a refreshing alternative to bland political speak where politicians say the things that they're supposed to say and everybody knows that there's something more going on there. So, I mean, it is a human failing, a little unfortunate, a bit of a shame that he felt he had to go down that path, not just of praising the American economy, but of also finding others to disparage. But I think it's on balance, it's probably a human failing that we can live with. I can think of worse.
Yossi, what do you think of these kind of things? I mean, are we done with the diplomatic niceties at this point in our society? Is that part of what this is about?
Sometimes it's nice actually to know what politicians actually think, instead of what the kind of the spin there, and a lot of comes with spin these days. So you don't know what they say and what they think and what they believe, and what's the connection between the three. As long as it doesn't cross certain lines. And again, offending an ally is never a good idea, and especially when things do change in this part of the world and China is the big bad wolf as far as the United States is concerned. No, it's not a good idea. I think he also got his fact. I think Japan is right and the reaction is right. He got, because I actually bothered to look at some of the figures when it comes. There are like 2 million foreign workers from different, including from Brazil and from East Europe in Japan. But this aside, yes, some frankness. Nothing wrong with that. When it crosses a line that you offend people and you harm your interests, that's a different matter.
Jenny, what do you make of that as well? Does the public like a straight talker these days? Is that the kind of politician we'd like getting elected, even if it is considered a gaffe by the media?
I think Americans do, maybe more so
yeah,
than some other people.
We've always kind of liked that, whether it's Reagan or others. I mean, we've kind of gone back in our traditions there.
Yes, I think so. I think there's a certain appeal to that, yes.
I think it's prime minister question right now, the difference between when Keir Starmer is there and Angela Rayner is there. It's a completely different prime minister question time. And, I think people enjoy when Angela Rayner is there. It's kind of bigger hitter than Keir Starmer. So, the public enjoys it.
Yeah, Yossi, there was one other person you wanted to highlight. We were talking about before the show, but just looking back at your country as well, Golda Meir was known, you were saying, for kind of saying also some quite... Yes. Offensive, borderline offensive, aggressive comments that sort of in the situation with Palestine that everyone kind of didn't want to say.
No, but she would say it kind of off the cuff. And one of the things that I mentioned to you earlier, she basically said to Palestinians that we'll never forgive the Palestinians to make our kids killing them. So not enough that actually there is occupation, there is an oppression, and as a result, killing of Palestinians, because they do it to our kids. So that's their fault. So this kind of thinking. And she has used kind of every, political opponents. She has something to say about how much she doesn't like them. But she was a straight talker. I think between being born in Russia and growing up in the United States, she got the best of very straight talking towards... Generally speaking, definitely when it came to political opponents.
Straight talkers have a long tradition in politics. Jenny Mathers and Yossi Mekelberg, thank you very much for joining us. Now, finally, on today's show, Croatia is gearing up for its annual tourist bonanza, with the crowd set to descend on the Adriatic coast during the summer months. But the capital, Zagreb, is also seeing more visitors. And unlike the coastal resorts, it has plenty of options on rainy days, not least a collection of museums, which have to be among the most eccentric in Europe. Do you want a museum of hangovers, torture, or broken relationships? Zagreb has one. And there are new institutions springing up all the time, as Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delaney, has been finding out.
This is Zagreb's Museum of Hangovers, and this is the place to come if you want to explore your relationship with alcohol. There are parts of the exhibition here which deal with every bit of the standard night out, from the good times through to the morning after, and the fuzzy bits in between.
My name is Rino Dubokovic. I'm founder of the Museum Hangovers. The first story in the museum that's highlighted, it's like the story of the bicycle pedal. We were in this local beer fest, and after this we went to the bar that was near. We talked about this, all these drunk stories and things like this. And my friend told how he woke up with the bicycle pedal. My idea was like, why there isn't like collection of all these stories and items? And that's how the idea started.
How is it that Zagreb has become the city of unusual museums? Because we have a Museum of Hangovers, Museum of Broken Relationships, Chocolate Museum, Torture Museum, Museum of Illusions, Museum of the 80s. You've even got the advert for it here, the Selfie and Memories Museum.
Yeah.
Why is all of this happening here?
I think it's a kind of thing that we have successful concepts that started like 10, 15 years ago. For this Museum Broken Relationship, they were first one. And then Museum of Illusions, they now selling the franchise all over the world, like around 40, 50 franchises. So, you know, lots of people are seeing them as an example. They are maybe thinking, okay, my neighbor have their own museum. I want to open my own.
Zagreb is now Museum Startup Central.
Yeah, museum starts here.
You might think that a collection of quirky upstart museums would find themselves in conflict with traditional tourist attractions, but visitors seem to be happy to embrace a culturally omnivorous approach.
They usually consume them in addition to the traditional ones.
Lana Maric-Stimac is the president of Zagreb's Association of Tourist Guides.
They first go to the archaeological museum. They want to see something related to the history of the city. And then they also want to see something else, something unusual and something rare. They want to visit the Museum of Illusions, Museum of Broken Relationships. This is something that is not traditionally linked to the history, but it has a certain charm. Like, you see something that is very, very original and that cannot be found anywhere else but here.
Well, this is the one which started it all. It's the Museum of Broken Relationships, and it's been operating in this old building in the upper town of Zagreb since 2010. And as you walk in, you see all the residue, the detritus from relationships which didn't go the distance. I'm standing next to a red racing bicycle. There's a pair of boots next to that. Along the wall there's a character, a doll from the Moomins. And as you go through, there's all sorts of weird and wonderful things that you can find, all of them curated by the team here, including one of the founders, Dražen Grubišić.
We start on the lighter note with the introductory stories that are short and funny and that kind of get you into this. And then the more you walk into the museum, we get into deeper and heavier and harder stories connected to family, loss, war. And then we, coming to the end, we go up again and finish on a lighter note or with the hopeful stories.
I'm just standing behind you. I can see a sign which says 27-year-old scab from my first love's wound. Imagine keeping such a thing.
And the story is even funnier because she's a biologist or something and she was madly in love, and at one moment she had a doubt of what would happen if something happened to him. So she decided she might take some physical part of him and maybe sometimes clone him. Isn't that a great idea? So that's what the scab is.
You call it a great idea. I call it distinctly odd. And she's not with him anymore because, of course, it's a broken relationship. I wonder why. That sounds to me like a narrow escape, frankly. And not for her.
Other meaningful exhibits include a plush Snoopy, an axe, and an espresso machine. In contrast to the content of the museum, relationships with the city authorities are positively cordial, and that goes for all the unusual institutions. Darija Dragoje is from Zagreb Tourist Board.
I'm not saying that classical museums, so to call them, are bad, but this diversity of the offer and the experience that they are offering to visitors is really something that attracts people to go to these museums and have a good time.
Do you ever have brainstorming sessions, Daria, where you sort of sit down and say, do you know what, the next museum we need is a museum of...
Well, it's not the way Zagreb Tourist Board functions.
This is fantasy time, Daria. Which one would you like to have set up in Zagreb?
Maybe the Museum of some colors and some light. We have also Festival of Lights with some light exhibitions and everything. I think that would be one very interesting point.
You heard it here first, and if it doesn't exist by the time you visit Zagreb, don't worry, there'll probably be another offbeat museum or three to choose from. For Monocle in Zagreb, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Guy Delaunay, thanks very much. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panelists today, Jenny Mathers and Yossi Meckelberg. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb, researched by Gunnar Grunlid, and our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Chris Chermak here in London. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.